The CNBC app. Global market news in one place. Customizable sections and personalized alerts. Stocks tracking, interactive charts and market insights all in your hands. Stay connected. Stay informed. Download the CNBC app today.
It's a very busy day here on Squawk Box with Karen Cho, Steve Sedgwick and Jeff Cutmore. And these are your headlines. HSBC posting its best quarter since the pandemic as first quarter profit surges 79%. The CFO, Ewan Stevenson, tells CNBC the lender is well positioned and shareholders can look forward to dividends again.
Certainly on the back of these results, it sets us up well for the year and our capacity to continue to see dividends grow from where we restarted last year.
UBS beats profit expectations in the first quarter as the Swiss lender says it exited all its US prime broker exposure after taking a 434 million Swiss franc hit. We're going to hear from the CEO, Ralph Hamers, at 8 CET.
Tesla posts record quarterly earnings as the electric car maker bet on Bitcoin adds more than $100 million to its bottom line. But CEO Elon Musk flags manufacturing difficulties amid the global chip shortage.
Q1 had some of the most difficult supply chain challenges that we've ever experienced in the life of Tesla. Insane difficulties with supply chain, with parts of over the whole range of parts.
Musk forecasts smooth seas ahead as the shipping giant lifts its four-year earnings guidance on strong demand and surging freight rates.
And a view from the C-suite this morning. We'll hear from the CEOs of UBS, BP and Novartis as earnings cross the wires. Plus, we'll speak with top executives from Novozymes and Hydro. All that coming up on CNBC. So a very warm welcome to the programme, everybody. In homage to Aberdeen, I almost feel that we should be called Stuv, Curran and Juf this morning. But you'll have seen that story, no doubt. Get a lot of social media commentary. And I dare say we'll talk about it a little later on in the programme. But when a rebranding exercise doesn't quite hit the mark, or maybe it does, we'll get your opinions on it. Anyway, we need to have a look at these Novartis numbers. So the first quarter a figure coming in at 0.91%. The net income declining 7%. They say mainly due to lower operating income here. The group says 2021 group guidance confirmed, noting Sandoz sales expectations. The business, of course, is made up of two operations. Ultimately, it's the innovative medicines business and the Sandoz business. The company says first quarter core net income in at 3.413 million. The group giving us a net sales line of 12.4 billion here. My revenue expectation was 12.53 billion. So that looks a little light of the expectation here. We were also looking for a net profit line in the 3.53 billion. So again, that looks like a slight miss. And Juliana, the problem with Novartis is it just seems to keep missing on the expectation here. We had the same experience on the fourth quarter. As we wait for the rest of these numbers to dribble in here, it does seem that this pharma company is unable to shake off some of the drag from COVID after the last 12 months.
It certainly seems to be the case, Jeff. I mean, the good thing here for investors is that they've confirmed their outlook for the year. They provided some guidance back at the end of January when they delivered their full year results. But it is interesting to see the impact that COVID is having on this company. Looking through the section where the company released their the impact from COVID, they note that for Sandoz, COVID-19 resulted in a historically weak cough and cold season, and so they saw softened retail demand. This is the portion of their business that is addresses the retail user base. So they are seeing the impact of COVID there. Novartis itself not involved directly in any of the vaccine development, but they have teamed up with several other pharma companies to assist in addressing COVID-19. And today they talk about their efforts to help manufacture COVID vaccine for CureVac. They've also been involved with BioNTech and Pfizer and Roche as well. So Novartis's role here has been to provide manufacturing capability to help those who have developed treatments and vaccines for COVID-19. They're also doing some investigative work of their own when it comes to potential COVID treatments. But I think here for investors, as you say, slightly below expectations on the performance in the first quarter, but they are sticking to that guidance for the full year. So potentially no major earnings changes for an analyst on the back of these numbers, guys.
All right. Terrific, Juliana. Thank you very much indeed for that. No doubt we'll talk some more in detail about this. In terms of the CEOs that we're conversing with this morning, Vas Narasimhan is very much on the table. The Novartis CEO will join us at 8:15 CET for a first on CNBC interview. Steve, I was tempted to try and do the whole program without any vowels in this morning, but I think that's beyond my mental capability at this hour. But
quality.
You no doubt will have seen the Aberdeen story as well.
I have. I was chortling away. And funnily enough, I saw that we had a really busy day with the corporates. We've got so many CEOs. And I was going to try and slip it in a bit later, but you just nailed it straight at the top of the show. So, you know, what can I say? But yeah, there's some great memes out there, I have to say. Memes, I should say.
Karen's just chuckling at the Aberdeen.
Aberdeen.
That's now going to be known as Aberdeen.
Aberdeen. Yeah, but Aberdeen. But it's just, it's a great rebranding. Anyone who Standard Life, have we explained what it is? Standard Life Aberdeen. Have rebranded basically, and it's now ABRDN, and that's it.
So it was a mouthful, right? I mean, they're having all the names butted together on the back of the deal making.
One vowel and a few consonants just chucked in now, though. Yeah.
Right. Yeah.
Anyway, it is a very funny story, and we'll no doubt pay homage to it many times over the next few weeks or so. UBS, that's an easy one. That is. UBS, basically. It's an acronym in itself. The numbers are actually very solid. First quarter profit up 14% as the Swiss bank has unveiled an Archegos charge. And I heard Jumana talking about these figures on Capital Connection. And that bit of a surprise to some that there is an Archegos charge, $434 million impact on the net profit in the first quarter. I say Archegos, it actually says default of US prime-based brokerage client. Mystery client, haven't mentioned the word Archegos, but we think it's Archegos. They said second quarter revenues to be influenced by seasonal factors such as lower client activity compared to Q1. And that's actually where the echoes are continuous, what we heard from Thomas Gottstein last week from your interview, Jeff, as well. So they had a whole multitude of issues over at Credit Suisse, including the fact that seasonal activity is going to tail off somewhat. But that's where the comparisons really finish, because as we know, and as I was saying last week, UBS trades at a significant premium to its Zurich peer, with a pretty much a price to book of 0.847 as opposed to Credit Suisse, which is languishing at around about 0.5. I'll just give you one or two more flashes as well. The return on tangible equity, and I think this is a really important number. We really do care about ROTE when looking at banking figures, was 14% in the first quarter on an annualized basis. So a really big number there. Wealth management really fizzing. Pre-tax profit up 16% to 1.409 billion.
It's interesting we're only hearing about this news around the US investment firm now, in terms of the disclosure that we had around Credit Suisse and all the twists and turns as it is forced to explain that exposure. Numa as well, that UBS is only coming forth with the information now. Is it because they held on to the portfolio?
Well, it's because they didn't have to as well. I'll just tell you why, because just in pure accounting, I'd imagine that if it's going to be a material impact on your results, as it was with the 4 billion plus handle over at Credit Suisse, you have to tell the market. You have to tell the market. But actually, the first quarter net attributable over at UBS has beaten expectations. They're up 14% year on year to 1.824 billion as opposed to expectations of 1.59. So yes, there was a material $434 million US dollar impact, but actually in terms of the net profits, they are still beating expectations.
It's interesting, isn't it? I wonder whether timing comes into the mix too, because we don't forget Credit Suisse was giving us that disclosure the other day in the conversation with Jeff about whether it made sense to hold on to the portfolio or whether it made sense to conduct a sale over the period of a number of weeks. Maybe UBS sold over the period of a couple of weeks as well, Jeff.
What do they say, Jeff? They say investors are just traders on the wrong side of the trade.
Yeah, absolutely. It's funny how it always becomes a long-term investment once you're offside. But I think you both make terrific points here, Steve. And yes, if it wasn't material, it wasn't necessary to disclose it here. But I think it does raise an interesting question as to how many other organisations may have somewhat been caught up in the Archegos story. And of course, until anything is proven to have been done wrong, this was a normal business activity with a punt on a family office that just ended up on the wrong side of the profit and loss ledger. So it is worth just pointing that out at this stage, because we don't have any evidence yet from any SEC investigation or any other regulatory body that anything was necessarily done illegally. Anyway, moving on to the other bank that we need to talk about this morning, HSBC. Of course, the numbers through, and they were stellar. The bank reported a 79% jump in first quarter profit, which comfortably beat the expectations. The lender says it will not pay quarterly dividends, but will consider an interim shareholder payout in August. And of course, that's a bit of an issue with a number of these banks, as they provisioned heavily through the pandemic period. They now have a liquidity glut, which they may be able to hand back to shareholders in a special. Well, HSBC CFO Ewan Stevenson spoke to our colleagues in Asia earlier and was asked what impact higher yields are playing on results.
High yields have very limited impact on these results, actually. It was mainly driven by good performances in non-interest income, coupled with a very sharp turnaround in credit relative to a year ago. But, very much our best quarter since the pandemic began.
All regions were profitable. The UK pre-tax profit coming in above $1 billion. What drove the strong numbers in various regions, if you perhaps want to start with the UK?
Yeah, in the UK, we actually made more profit this quarter than we made for the whole of 2020, very much driven by the turnaround in credit. What we've seen in places like the UK and US and elsewhere is a sharply improved economic outlook, and also a much reduced set of downside scenarios on the back of very successful vaccine rollout programs. So it really has been the success in the last couple of months of the progressive rollout of vaccines that's really changed the outlook for the UK and our financial performance.
Ewan, your Asian portion of the pre-tax profit continues to be the bulk of it, $3.75 billion against $3.74 in the year ago. So still continuing to improve there. We're watching you make this Asia pivot. Can you talk us through a little bit about that? How much more can you be able to get out of the Asian region? Where are you focusing in specifically in terms of the countries here in Asia? And on those reports, there have been reports about moving executives back to Hong Kong. Where are you guys in those plans?
Yeah, so we're very excited about the growth opportunities in Asia. As you say, it was another great quarter for the team down there. In terms of focus for us, Hong Kong, obviously, a big continued push into mainland China, seeking to bulk up our operations in the ASEAN region, particularly Singapore, and the offshore market in India. We are committed to shifting executives down there. We announced a week or so ago that we're shifting three of four of our global business CEOs down to Hong Kong over the next few months. And we do expect going forward to really run a dual hub operation based in London and Hong Kong.
CFO of HSBC, Ewan Stevenson there. And of course, our Asia colleagues focused primarily on the business in Asia, which is a strong driver of bank profitability. But it is just worth noting, I think, for us in Europe, that the bank was able to release $400 million of provisions, and ultimately those provisions would have been for bad debts. The expectation was that they would have been in the UK, but as the bank noted in the earnings announcement this morning, the write-back reflected an improvement in the economic outlook, quote, notably in the UK. So another bank that's pointing to the UK recovery as we get relief from the pandemic lockdowns, and suggesting actually the bad debt situation won't be as bad as previously anticipated, which has got to be good news as we look to the next quarter for the bank here, even though it says it won't be releasing further provisions beyond the first quarter, guys.
Just very quickly for me, there's a lot to like in this report as well, but there's also one or two areas of concern. ROTE, again, you get a double-digit handle on the ROTE. I think that's always good. Return on tangible equity, great, 10.2%. That is up 6 percentage points year on year, so really sorting out the book there as well. Obviously, the common equity tier one capital ratio of 15.9%, that makes it look well capitalized. But the area where I always hate to see is net interest margin of 1.21%, down 33 basis points on the first quarter 2020. So your NIMS, one of your key metrics, your net interest margins, I think really disappointing to be losing so much ground on that. But then I guess that's the nature of the fact that we've got zero interest rates around the world.
Well, that's the thing with some of these more international banks. You used to get the much higher interest rates in the emerging markets, which meant that you had much higher returns when you looked at the interest margins. But that's clearly changed with central banks everywhere cutting around the COVID crisis. So it has closed the gap of sorts with some of these international banks and those that are very focused in jurisdictions like Europe. When it comes to the earnings, I mean, Jeff just called out the UK. If you look at the profit per region on the quarter this time versus same time a year ago, that profit in the UK more than doubled. So you can see the enormous pickup there. A little bit firmer in Asia. Europe also effectively doubled too. That's improved. North America, you've seen a little bit of a pickup there, but still lower ranges, I've got to say. Looking at MENA and LATAM, those markets could certainly do with some improvement. And some of the other bits that jump out too, I mean, you've seen wealth balances. That's ticked up by 23%. So this is telling you about the wealth of some individuals at the bank. Also, when it comes to Hong Kong, card spending up 12%. And we've been looking towards some of those Asian markets to see what lies ahead in terms of consumption patterns. So I think that's quite interesting just to take a look at.
Yeah, I just, again, as is my wont, I just do my European versus US banking comparison again. And I know that interest rates are negative across Europe, but what have we got to do to find a bank in Europe with a price to book above one? The answer is it's seemingly impossible. Even UBS, great figures, you know, 0.87, I think it is. Lloyd's in the UK, pretty much seen to sort itself out, 0.67. Banco Santander, one we always talk about, price to book the next 12 months, 0.597. We'll call it 0.6, given that. ING, where Ralph Hamers has come from, 0.725. What have we got to do to convince, what have the banks got to do to convince people that their books are worth what they've got it valued at, the price to book? And maybe that means that some of the market is still sceptical about the valuation of the assets on the book.
Can I talk about cost quickly? Because I think that's what we've seen from some of the major banks, this drive to cut our costs and how they're doing it. It's about the move towards digital. I was just staggered by this number that they mentioned around mobile downloads, up 73%. Versus the same time a year ago. Volume of payments up 320% over the same period on the HSBC mobile app. So that is telling you a story about people not going into branches as more and using the mobile phone device to make those transactions. That's a huge change.
I hate to say it. I mean, you know, someone who grew up on the branch network, but it's dead, isn't it, the branch network? I mean, whether people know it or not, it's gone. No, that's a bit of a statement, but I mean, over the next 5 to 10 years, who goes into bank branches anymore?
I did once for a novelty to put a check in, but that was about it, right?
Well, yeah, but as soon as I taught my mother with her banking app, if I can teach my mother with her banking app to take a photo of the back and the front of a check and then put a check in like that, that's kind of almost one of the last people to need to ever go into using a paper check. You know, the fact that you even get these things these days. And to put it electronically, it's almost a death knell, isn't it?
Yeah. I mean, it's annoying to receive a cheque in the first place in 2021.
well, indeed. Let's move on from banking. Maersk has raised its full-year guidance after reporting first quarter revenue of $12.4 billion in preliminary results. I hate the word preliminary. Do you read it like particulary?
Preliminary.
Preliminary. It's like Aberdeen. No, anyway, the Danish shipping giant cited surging demand and said average freight rates had had surged 35%. I tell you, I'm surprised they're only up 35% from the people I know who are trying to use containers at the moment. And that's in the first 3 months. And Maersk also hiked its guidance for global growth, but warned that volatility remains. Yeah, I heard a story about, well, I just read a story about an English wine producer, very famous English wine producer, trying to send a pallet of their sparkling wine over to the continent. It used to be 150 quid. Now the suppliers, if you can get one, they want, and this is obviously a Brexit issue, £500 to £700 they want per pallet.
Which obviously drives up the sparkling versus champagne and makes it a little bit less
competitive. Or means you can't export as well. But that's not inflation, everybody. Nothing to worry about. All right, let's move on. Coming up on the show, a top White House advisor says a proposed hike in capital gains taxes won't weigh on investment as President Biden gears up to reveal a new economic plan in a speech to Congress this week.
And for more reaction to today's slew of corporate earnings, you can check out the Squawk Box podcast.
Listen to CNBC's Beyond the Valley, the podcast that explores the biggest tech news from across the globe. Join me, Arjun Karpal.
And me, Tom Chitty, every week as we bring you insights into the top stories, unpack the latest trends, and find out where the industry is headed.
Now available on Spotify, Apple Music, and Google Podcasts.
Let me take you to some of that U.S. market action. A fresh record on the street for the S&P and the NASDAQ. It's taken some time for the technology index to get back to those peak levels, but it seized upon some of those records yesterday in the trading session. Also for the S&P 500, it's been a fairly significant week in the lead up to this corporate earnings reveal. Markets been looking for the evidence in those report cards, and it was quite telling in the lead up to big tech names that Amazon was one of the positive catalysts for the two major indices. They reached for those fresh record levels, but you can see the Dow going in the opposite direction, just pulling back almost 0.2%. You know, this week, other than corporate earnings, we're also shaping up for a little bit more of a dovish Fed two-day meeting beginning today, and markets are very much clued into the messaging from Powell about being supportive for markets. That said, we have had stronger data recently, so investors looking for any gear shift at all from the central bank. Look at the Treasury markets. We did have an auction of Treasuries yesterday at the 2 and the 5. The 2 was a little bit soft, the 5 a little bit more supportive, but we did see a slight march up in yields. 1.57 is where we are currently at this stage. Just so investors just closely eyeing some of these auctions and also what we're hearing from the corporates and whether that does mean we get a bit more life back into this yield, which of course has come off the 1.77% level we had in March. Now, the dollar, which has been reeling from the weakness in the Treasury market, you can see how we're trading this morning. It is trying to claw back a little bit of territory versus sterling. 138.89, we were sitting on that trade this morning. Euro dollar, 120.71. Dollar supported versus the Japanese yen, also the Chinese currency. So not a bad morning after what has been fairly solid weakness in the lead up to the Fed meeting, hovering around multi-week lows for the greenback. In terms of Asian markets, a little bit of a focus on the Bank of Japan today, and as we talk about this inflation story and the central banks holding the line if they're going to pick up in prices. Fascinating again to hear the BOJ projecting that it will miss its inflation target of 2% for years. So a little bit like the narrative we had pre-pandemic, still this missing of targets by the central bank there. But don't forget, of course, Tokyo in its third two-week state of emergency, and the country, of course, reeling from COVID too. The Japanese market trading lower, patches of weakness too for China and for Australia, but a little bit of green just moving on to the Hong Kong market. I want to show you copper. This is seen as a barometer of growth, and we did see a fairly significant rally in the price in recent weeks, and this is what it looks like even in recent months. 91% higher from same time a year ago. You can see we're perched above 9,800 points. We're at the highest level since about August 2011. So a fair amount of time has transpired from those highs. Very strong performance on the month too, up 10-odd%. In terms of the soft commodities, it's not just copper that has been rallying in the commodity space. Corn, soybean, wheat also showing signs of life too. We've had corn at its highest level since about 2013. 2013 levels too on soybean futures and wheat, rounding out that mix. So multi-year highs is what we're now witnessing on this side. Well, for CNBC Pro subscribers, some stocks to watch. Check out which companies UBS expects to pass costs on to consumers amid a potential uptick in inflation. That's available on our website, cnbc.com. White House economic advisor Brian Deese says a proposed rise in capital gains taxes will impact less than 1% of Americans and won't hit long-term investment. Deese also argued the higher levies will help fund a massive new spending plan, which President Biden is expected to lay out to Congress this week.
This change will only apply to 0.3% of taxpayers, which is not the top 1%. It's not even the top 0.5%. We're talking about 0.3%. That's about 500,000 households in the country that we're talking about.
Thank you for listening to Squawk Box Europe Express.
For more market-moving news, you can head to cnbc.com.
Or join us again on the show with Jeff Cutmore, Steve Sedgwick and Karen Cho, weekdays on CNBC.